Last week, I gave you a small introduction into who St. Mark was, the author of the Gospels that we're going to be hearing for the next 11 months to 12 months, this church year, year B. And I explained to you that Mark was most probably John Mark, that he was quite scholarly, so he knew Greek and he would have known Latin. And of course, he knew his native Hebrew or Aramaic, depending. He wrote his letter from Rome to mainly Jewish, to non-Jewish converts to the way, to following Christ. So it's just helpful to keep that in mind. And it was written around about the 50-year mark after Jesus died, thereabouts. It's just helpful to keep that in mind, and that's why I say it again this week. Now, Mark, when he begins his gospel, which is actually what you've got today, it's the beginning, Mark knows his First Testament, or his Old Testament, as some people refer to it. Mark knows that very well. And so he begins, actually, by quoting from the prophet Isaiah. And the portion that he quotes from the prophet Isaiah was written at the time that the Jewish people in exile, after the destruction of the temple in 537, people in exile in Babylon were really starting to feel downcast. And he was, the author of Isaiah, was preparing the people to return back to Israel and then ultimately back to their capital, Jerusalem, and rebuild the temple. Now, things didn't happen as fast as the Jews would have liked. And so it was the prophet's duty to, in a sense, boost their hopes, to give them some encouragement. And that's what the author in Isaiah is doing. Come forward to the gospel, and we have Mark describing Jesus as the Christ, and then he calls him the Son of God. That's interesting because at the time that Mark wrote his gospel, it was very apparent that Jesus wasn't returning by the end of this sermon. And so Mark is also giving us some encouragement, some enlightenment into who Jesus was and why we have to live a life that is worthy while we wait. But he sets the scene by following the text almost from Genesis, which is the creation story, in the beginning. That's how he starts off. And then we have here in the beginning of the good news. He uses the word good news because he knows to his Roman audience that word, the gospel there, good news, translates in the Roman mind to the approval that is stamped by the emperor. So it's language that Romans would understand. It's translated down the track into language that we understand as the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. But it was clearly to get between the ears of the Romans that what Caesar or the emperor stamps is nothing compared to what the footstep of Jesus Christ has done in our lives and in the world. So he's building up, he's setting the scene for who Jesus is. He calls him the Christ, which means the anointed. Now, that will only be referred to again at the end of the first part of Mark's gospel, the word Christ. But Christ, the anointed, with the language of anointing, when the kings were anointed, the oil, the perfumed oil, actually was poured on their head and it ran down their body, but down their beard, and it's described as running down. We even hear the language running down the beard of Aaron. The whole purpose of the perfumed oil being poured over them was not that they're going to baste them like a Christmas turkey. It was because it was believed that this holy oil filled the very person with God's presence, took over who they were, and that filling is what overflowed into the people around them. So the smell would have wafted into those around. Mark then introduces for us John the Baptist. Just keep that image in mind, the complete overtaking, overwhelming. He then introduces John the Baptist. He describes John the Baptist in the same description as what the prophet Elijah is described. The audience would have known that, the Jewish audience. So he dresses him in the camel coat and eating wild honey, etc. Now, John the Baptist, look at the word baptism. Baptism actually means overwhelm. So come back to the anointing, the oil. Baptism means to be overwhelmed with water. Not just, unfortunately, our image of baptism these days is a little bit kind of, well, it's been watered down. It's a little bit ordinary. Baptism was to be completely immersed, completely wet, solid, through and through with the water. It was a really big statement. And it's interesting that in our baptism ritual, we have the anointing again, comes back in with chrism, and we have, well, we can completely immerse, we can do that. It's just a practical reason why most of us don't in most of our churches. So the baptism that John has his title from and that he carries out was a complete overwhelming of a new beginning. And Mark goes to a lot of trouble to make sure that people know that this new beginning comes with Jesus, the Anointed One. So he's locking all of the ancient symbols together and he's brought it into the present. Now, for us sitting here at Pierce at this time, 2 weeks out of Christmas or 3 weeks out of Christmas, we tend to think, oh, well, what's it got to do with us? You're not going to go home and pour oil all over yourselves, I'm sure. You're not going to go home and throw yourselves into the pool. Well, you might, I don't know. But you certainly won't be using the language of chrism and you won't be using the language of baptism. So what language do we use to get us to understand and immerse ourselves in these readings, second week of Advent? And I suggest to you that the language is the language of the journey. The journey. Now, some of you are preparing to go on holidays now. The preparation for your holiday, the journey, will be things you'll be on whatever website you're on trying to get the best deal. You'll be looking at the weather. You'll be looking at traffic down the track. All of those things you take into account as you prepare for your journey, whatever that might be. In Isaiah, the first reading from Isaiah, we've got the people preparing for the journey back to Jerusalem, back to their heart of hearts. In the Gospel, we have Mark, through John the Baptist, saying, at the authorship of Mark, saying, make straight his path, the way for the Lord. Actually uses the word highway. Now, God doesn't need a highway. His path doesn't need to be straight. It's our path that needs to be straight. In comes the second reading from St. Peter. How do we make our path straight? And then you've got that beautiful recipe in there for making your path straight from the second letter of St. Peter. You should be living holy and saintly lives while you wait and long for the day of God. All of us are impatient. Every one of us. That building, I'm so impatient to have it finished. We're supposed to be done for you now, but it's not. Through no fault of any individual. So it's a lesson in patience for me in nearly everything I do and say when it comes to proclaiming the gospel. Be patient. Somebody comes into Mass late. I don't know what's gone on in their life that held them up. I don't have a clue. So I don't need to go to judging them. I need to be patient. They're here. Don't give lectures to people who are at Mass about money. They're here. They give. Don't tell people who are at Mass about the way to live their life. They're here. They know that. The difficulty is, and my impatience, and probably some of yours, especially with your children, perhaps, and your grandchildren, is that what we see in here, we can't get out there to those that we know need to hear it. And if they would hear it and believe it like us, then they'd be here. And I'd be putting on an extra Mass on the weekend. That's okay, that'll pay for the car park. But so there are frustrations built into the journey of our life. And I just gave you some slightly personal examples there. What we are waiting for is what he promised, the new heaven and the new earth, the place where, and this is the clangor, righteousness will be at home. And righteousness is the key to our journey. It's the key to our security, our safety. It's the planning of our journey. And you're going to say, oh, righteousness, another big Bible word. It's a magnificent word, used more in the Old Testament than what it is in the New Testament. Righteousness has two elements. The first is justice. In other words, be just in your dealing with people, but particularly be just in your dealing with God. The second part of righteousness has to do with living the right life. Coming back to the text of St. Peter's letter there again. How to live a good and saintly life. So it's about being just and it's about living life right. That's what Advent is all about. Squaring away our justice and getting our life back into balance and proportion. That's what it is. So as you plan your journey, either the journey through your Christmas holiday or the journey through your life, keep righteousness right up the top of your planning list. Justice and living by that which is right and proper and good. Some people might even go stretch it to say the law, living by the law. And our law is God's law of love. Micah gives you the best recipe for your journey, which is to act justly, love tenderly, and walk humbly with your God.